Support for WMFE comes from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University's worldwide campus, where highly ranked online degree programs offer the flexibility to learn what students want from wherever they are. More at erau.edu/worldwide.
Voter rules could soon be changing in Florida. State House lawmakers passed an elections overhaul that would take effect next year if the legislation is also passed by the state Senate. We're breaking down what every voting age Floridian needs to know. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. It is March 5th, 2026. Municipal elections are happening now in Central Florida. Early voting is underway in Orange County for council or commission seats in Apopka, Maitland, Oakland, and Eatonville. Starting next year, in 2027, the identification required to cast a ballot could be much different. A new election bill approved by the State House and now awaiting action in the Senate would make Floridians show proof of U.S. citizenship before voting and would limit the types of identification people could use at the polls. The bill was introduced by Fort Myers Republican Representative Jenna Persons Mullica and passed along party lines after hours of debate. The official name of HB 991 is an act related to election integrity. And during session last week, Mullica spoke about why this legislation is important.
This bill strengthens our citizenship verification process, provides for a common sense list of voter ID, and it stops foreign interference in our elections. Highlights include the following. It requires citizenship verification at the time of voter registration or change in registration. It requires a citizen's legal status as a U.S. citizen to be included on Florida driver licenses and ID cards beginning July 1st, 2027. The bill revises the list of valid picture identification that will be acceptable at the polls. The bill requires an automated, independent vote validation process for every ballot cast in every election prior to certification. It strengthens our prohibition on foreign interference and closes any loophole on foreign money flowing through third parties into our state to influence our elections.
The proposal makes several changes to Florida's election laws. The ones that would affect most voters would not take effect until after this year's midterm elections. Let's walk through some that would begin in 2027. Florida law already requires voters to affirm that they are U.S. citizens when they sign their voter registration form. Under the bill, if the state can't verify someone's citizenship through government records, that person would be labeled an unverified voter. They could still cast a provisional ballot that would only count if they provide proof of citizenship within 2 days after the election. The bill also narrows the list of accepted photo IDs at the polls. Student ID cards, retirement center identification, debit and credit cards with a photo, neighborhood association identification, and public assistance IDs would no longer be accepted. To get a better understanding of how this could affect voting in the state, I spoke with Orange County Supervisor of Elections, Karen Castor-Dental.
My concern is removing student IDs. Not all students have driver's licenses these days, but it's a lot fewer than when I was getting my driver's license, when everyone wanted to get that. So not all students, if they don't use their student IDs, they're not all going to have their driver's license readily available either. So it's going to affect college-age students. We have so many colleges here in Orange County and in Central Florida. You know, UCF is one of the largest colleges in the country. And if they're not able to use their student IDs, and that has a big impact on voters in Orange County and Seminole County and Volusia County. Here in Florida, we have a lot of seniors, and in their assisted living or their nursing homes, sometimes they just have an ID from their nursing home or assisted living. And they would have to then go through a whole other process of getting an updated or valid driver's license or state ID and have to provide their birth certificates as well. And I don't see what problem they're solving. I think they're creating more problems with this effort.
Let's look at what this could look like on the ground from someone who helps run voting sites and is trained to ensure the process is secure. Kathy Swerdlow is a current poll worker and the president of the nonpartisan organization League of Women Voters of Seminole County. She says Florida already has multiple safeguards in place to prevent election issues, and based on her experience, she hasn't seen evidence that non-citizens voting is a widespread problem here.
There have been surveys on voting conducted by everybody from the Heritage Foundation to the Cato Institute to the Brennan Center for Justice, all finding nominal, less than 1%, 0.00% of non-citizen voting. So I just don't believe that it is an issue. And a question I would have to any current office holders is whether they feel that their election to office was fraudulent. If this is such a big issue, then maybe we should question your election to office. But I don't ever hear that from them.
How do you think this could affect voters in Seminole County?
Well, it has the potential to seriously impact them. The way that I understand the bill, and there's slight differences between the House bill and the Senate bill, so there'll have to be some reconciliation and finalization to have it sent to the governor. But it's my understanding that they're going to take every registered voter and use the DMV database to check citizenship. Now, if many voters who don't have a driver's license or a Florida ID, so those will be already thrown out. They will then be given 30 days to present to the supervisor of elections the appropriate documentation. And again, the documentation is going to be hard to get, might take longer than 30 days to get it if you have to get your birth certificate from some other state. And if you're a woman and your married name that you go by now does not match the name on your birth certificate, you have to get that kind of documentation as well. All of this stuff is not free. All of it costs money. All of it takes time. And to pass this kind of legislation that isn't needed in the first place and do it with such a short window before an election, I think the numbers of people to be disenfranchised are much greater than any potential number of non-citizen voting. It's like taking a sledgehammer to kill a fly.
We've heard a lot of rhetoric about election integrity. What impact does that language have on voters, on volunteers locally?
I think it's very discouraging, very disheartening. I've worked the polls myself. I feel extremely confident in the process. I think that, especially since the 2000 election, when Florida was the kingpin of what happened, huge efforts were made to improve our systems to the point where we really run a very smooth election with lots of checks and balances and paper ballots that are tallied and can easily be audited. I just think that we run a really great system here in Florida. And the beauty of it is that it's a very decentralized system. There's not going to be any way that somebody's going to impact what's going on. You know, when I work the polls, everybody is signing off on every step of the process. Every person that's working the polls sign off on every step of the process. We run a tally before we leave, and we hang that tally on the window of the polling place. And then two people from two different parties take that locked, sealed case that all of the optically scanned votes went into, take it to the SOE. This idea that somebody's going to get in there and change votes is just not based in reality.
Those steps you just described to me, is that what you were referring to in it being decentralized?
Well, I'm decentralizing that stuff isn't going over the internet. You know, none of the tallies are going over the internet. The vote count is in the machine, and then the ballots are separate once they've run through because it's optically scanned. There is connectivity in a polling center for checking people in, because you're probably not old enough, but I remember going to vote and having these huge ledgers, and you had to find your name and then sign your name next to your name. That's how you checked in to vote back 50 years ago.
What would you say to someone who believes stricter proof of citizenship rules are just common sense?
If they think that it's common sense, and if they think that that's something that we really should do, then it should be free and easy to get that proof of citizenship. It shouldn't be a huge bureaucratic hassle and monetary thing for people to vote. No problem. You want to make sure that only citizens vote, then you provide the citizenship documentation to every citizen in the United States free of charge, and they'll bring it to the polls and show it. I mean, it's really not a voter ID thing. It really is interfering with the ability to cast your ballot.
That was Kathy Swerdlow, president of the Nonpartisan League of Women Voters of Seminole County. Florida HB 991 that was passed in the House is written to take effect January 1st, 2027. A similar companion bill in the Senate makes changes effective in July of this year before the midterm elections. Florida's Office of Election Crimes and Security, created to investigate claims of voter fraud, sent a report to the governor in January. It found that last year, 198 likely non-citizens illegally registered or voted. The Florida Division of Elections reports there were 13.3 million registered voters in the state last year. Next on Engage, how the Florida proposal mirrors proposed changes at the federal level. Plus, Iranian Americans gathered in downtown Orlando to celebrate a moment many have waited decades to see. And we'll hear from the first Iranian American elected to the Florida legislature about her hopes for what comes next. Subscribe to the Engage podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you never miss an episode.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and liftoff of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. Before the break, we talked about the Florida House bill that would make changes to the state's election laws, including new citizenship verification steps and updated voter identification rules. That Florida proposal mirrors one on the federal level. The Safeguard American Voter Eligibility Act, also called the Save America Act, passed the U.S. House in February. That Republican-backed bill would make all federal voters prove they're U.S. citizens before voting. Critics say this is voter suppression, not fraud prevention, noting non-citizen voting is rare and illegal. Its supporters say it is needed to make sure only citizens vote in elections. U.S. Congressman Mike Haradopoulos' federal district includes Brevard and Indian River, as well as parts of Orange County. He explains why he says proof of citizenship is necessary and elaborates on his concerns about non-citizens voting. So the Save America Act is based on restoring voter integrity. Help me understand, what has compromised that integrity?
Well, I think in general that, as you probably know, 14 states currently do not even require an identification in order to vote. And as you probably know also, when you actually get a driver's license, that also does not let people know if you're an American citizen or not, though the Real ID Act is slowly moving in that direction. I think that given the concerns that Democrats had about the 2016 election, when you had people like McGovern, Pelosi, Raskin, Jeffries, Maxine Waters, all calling President Trump an illegitimate president. And then in 2020, of course, the controversies that followed there as well. One great way to restore some trust back in our elections so that a lot of these voices are silenced is to give people the confidence to know that when you go to vote, that just like before you get on an airplane, that you have a scenario where people will show their ID so that they do not vote in either multiple sites or at least verifying that they have the proper identification and showing that they are an American citizen, which has come into question given the fact that 10 million people approximately entered the country illegally between 2021 and 2024.
Just to clarify real quick, you mentioned the controversy of 2020 elections. What are you referring to?
Well, as we all know, there was a lot of controversy about 2016. There's a lot of tape that, whether it be Hillary Clinton or others, talked about the illegitimacy of Trump and how the elections have been influenced. And then, of course, the controversies after the 2020 elections, which culminated in that horrible situation on January 6th. And so I think what we need to do as members of Congress is to create some common sense ideas like voter ID, which again does not exist in 14 states, and try to put that forward, and also to make sure that when people are registered to vote that they are actual American citizens. I talked to my own supervisor of elections who, when they went through their voter rolls, there were many people that are found to be not American citizens, and they were, of course, removed from the voter rolls.
Let me expand on that. What evidence is there that undocumented residents are voting?
Well, one simple evidence is the idea that I talked to my supervisor of elections, and when he went through the rolls, he found people who admitted that they were not American citizens and who had voted, and they were turned into the local election authorities. And whether it be one or 1,000 or 10,000 or 10 million, every vote should be one person, one vote. And to build on that same idea, we had a recent election in West Melbourne where an election was literally decided by one vote. But I think it's vital that what we'd want to do is instill confidence in our election systems. And as you probably know, there are some states that give people who are not American citizens driver's licenses. And so all we're trying to do is make sure that in an American election, that American only vote, and they decide the future of America. And then, of course, the elected representatives and senators, will, let alone state representatives and state senators and governors, can govern accordingly.
Let me ask you how the Save America Act would impact people who don't have easy access to the original citizenship documents. I'm looking at research by the Brennan Center in 2024, found 21.3 million Americans do not have ready access to a passport or birth certificate. That's more than 9% of voting-aged Americans.
Well, first of all, the Brennan group, they might call themselves bipartisan. I've been on television shows with them before. They're a very left-wing organization. I think that's one thing you might want to check a little closer. But that said, I think that if you want to board a plane, you need a driver's license and an ID. And because you know the new Real ID standards as well. And if you know, when a person gets married, they go through this process with a name change. And I found it incredibly insulting when they start saying that minorities don't have the ability to go in and get a driver's license, et cetera. It's almost racist what some of the language they're using. I'm not sure where the Brennan group gets their information, but when the changes were instituted in the state of Georgia, they tried to tighten up the voter rolls. You actually saw a larger turnout the next election cycle. If people want to vote, it's not a difficult process. It's the reason why I sat down with my supervisor elections and asked how hard is it to register, and it's a very simple process. And if there's any discrepancies, if there is a person who came to vote and there's some question whether they were legitimately elected, elector or not, there's actually a provisional ballot that's cast so that someone would not be that denied that they can go through the process, et cetera. And so there are many safeguards in place, but I'm shocked that, you know, there are 14 states that don't require photo identification in order to do this. And that's, to me, is very bizarre. I mean, if we have standards to get on an airplane or get on, for that matter, buy alcohol or open a bank account or drive or, you know, check into a hotel, you got to show your identification. And for that matter, when I go to vote on the floor of Congress, I've got to show my photo ID and stick it in a machine and vote. And so it's just a common sense way to prevent fraud. And as you know, when sometimes you send out live ballots, which some states did during COVID and other states do regardless, that if that the person's no longer living there, it can easily be put into the system, which again would undercut the simple idea, as you know, one person, one vote.
Representative, you mentioned married women. I hear a lot from critics that married women whose legal ID name doesn't match their birth certificates could be disenfranchised. How would this impact those who legally changed their name?
Well, again, I've talked to a lot of women across the community. When they got married, they went in to the supervisor elections and change it to their new legal name. And with the verification checks that are readily available in all supervisors' office, it's easily done. If there's any confusion about it, they offer them many alternatives in which to make sure that those measures are protected so you don't lose that ability to vote. It's as you probably know, when you talk to most people, when they do get married, they have a name change, they go into the supervisor elections office and make those changes. And if they had a real ID, which is of course in case when they can check citizenship in most cases, it's easily verified. And if there's any questions about it, there's more than enough time to clear those up.
Bill has passed the House, currently in the Senate. Where's your confidence that it will actually pass?
I don't know if it will pass or not. The Democrats seem pretty dug in that they don't think that voter ID is necessary. I happen to disagree. Again, if I don't know why anyone would say, why deny voter identification, unless you're trying to do nefarious things. And I'm not alone in my opinion. As you probably have seen the opinion polls, at least 75% of all voters believe that there should be voter identification before you go and cast your vote. Of course, among Republicans, the high number is much higher. And again, what's been shocking in some of the language that's been used is somehow if you're a married woman, you can't figure out how to make these adjustments, or if you're an African-American or Hispanic or other minority group, that you can't figure it out. It's to me almost racial insult that they can't figure it out.
What's your response to talk of nationalizing the midterm elections in select states?
Well, again, I don't know what it means by nationalizing election. I mean, again, the Congress has long had a role in setting up standards. As I mentioned, back in the 1845, they established November elections for Congress. In the 1960s, they established, of course, Voting Rights Act. And the 1980s, making sure that handicapped citizens had access to vote. And that's not even counting, of course, the Congress's role in a constitutional amendment, whether it be the 15th, the 19th, the 24th, the 26th amendments, all had a congressional role. So I don't think it's nationalizing an election. What I do think is that historically you've set up basic safeguards and standards so that people have confidence in elections.
That was U.S. Congressman, Republican Representative Mike Haradopoulos. Beyond the politics of these debates, there are constitutional questions about how far lawmakers can go in regulating elections. Leroy Purnell is a professor of law at Florida A&M University College of Law in Orlando. We're hearing this talk about nationalizing the elections. My first question is, can the president take control from local boards and nationalize the administration of elections as being suggested?
I find that extremely questionable as a matter of constitutional law. It's been pretty clear in terms of past pronouncements from the United States Supreme Court that the Constitution envisions the eligibility for voting in elections being a matter for the state and not for federal intervention. The only exception to that historically has been recognized is where the state engages in procedures that are in violation of the 15th Amendment in terms of discrimination. And that's because the 15th Amendment specifically authorizes Congress to enforce the 15th Amendment. But there's no such provision, explicit or implied, that anyone at the federal level can dictate how elections are to be handled or who may vote or who qualifies as a voter.
Can DHS legally deploy agents to patrol election sites?
Now, and there are a couple of other issues involved with this, but just taking that at the face value, there would be no authority to do that. And the Constitution, if we look at the purpose of such deployment, since it is within the realm of the states to determine how votes are to be carried out, there's no authority of anyone outside of just being a citizen observer as to how states would conduct an election. I would find that to be extremely questionable. Particularly, now we're crossing into the realm of voter intimidation. So what is the purpose of law enforcement agencies being on site to watch people vote? That, I think, smacks of voter intimidation.
Is that against the law?
It would be if the intimidation is designed to deny individuals the right to vote, and particularly if the historical patterns would suggest that that denial is having a impact that could be tied to the 15th Amendment in terms of race discrimination. Voter intimidation, whether it's carried out at the state level or the federal level, is at the very least questionable under the Constitution, and certainly as to other statutory law in existence, there's no justification to intimidate voters. To the extent that a voting system allows any person to be present at the sites, that's fine. But when the role of law enforcement is to give a presence there that is intimidating, then I think there could be a problem.
We hear a lot about non-citizens voting as a reason for needing to crack down on election integrity. Is that actually happening?
Generally, when this issue has been raised to the extent that courts have the challenge brought before them, there's been no established pattern of significant voting fraud in that regard. I mean, any system you're going to have, sometimes it breaches. But I don't have any information that would suggest that this is a widespread problem.
What concerns you ahead of the upcoming midterms?
Well, I think that, aside from the constitutional question as to the power outside of a particular jurisdiction to change their voting qualification procedures and requirements, I'm concerned that the intent behind any attempt to monitor change or control that is implemented in a way that will discourage any segment of American citizens who wish to vote to vote. And I think that to the extent that there are any issues that someone is seeking to take a political or social advantage of, that is a problem. And I think that the Constitution, again, I keep coming back to the 15th Amendment. Those are some of the things that, in light of the duty placed on Congress as a result of the 15th Amendment, those were some of the concerns that the Voting Rights Act was addressing. So those concerns, I think, are still there. And I think we have to look at substance over form in the sense of what is the impact of any of these changes in terms of what motivates someone or any jurisdiction, whether it be federal or state, to make these changes, and the impact it has on American citizens that should have a right to vote without significant barriers being placed in their way. Anything you would do that would impact how voters vote is dealing with a substantial right. And for any governmental action to impinge upon a substantial right, there has to be some strong, substantial, and in some instances, compelling justifications to do so. And so you have to be very careful that mere statements of voter fraud without any indication of that being a substantial issue raises questions as to the constitutional permissibility of implementing anything that would interfere with and deter individuals' rights to vote.
While debates over election security and integrity continue, local election officials are preparing for what will happen. We ask Orange County Supervisor of Elections Karen Castor-Dental about concerns ranging from threats of nationalizing operations to safety and immigration officials at the ballot box.
What would you tell people who are hearing about reports of placing ICE agents at polling places?
I've heard that spoken to, and I would just say that it helps to be prepared as a voter. It helps to be prepared with all of your methods available to you of voting. So we have three different ways to vote. We have voting on election day at your assigned precinct. We have early voting, and that usually is about 2 weeks long in Orange County leading up to election day. And then there's also the option of vote by mail, which you can vote, you can request your vote by mail ballot. It will be mailed and delivered to your home. But knowing that you have options, I think, will help us mitigate any of those kinds of rumors and also be prepared for any eventuality. We are working very closely with election protection teams and election monitors. So we're going to have plans in place for our elections to run smoothly. And I just want the voters to also have a plan.
We've heard rhetoric at the national level that includes threats to nationalize election operations, or at least in select states. Have you had any discussions with other election supervisors in Florida about this?
Yes, and we're all in agreement that the states and local counties run our elections. So there might be discussion about it. There might be people who say that's going to happen, but I don't foresee that happening. It is in the purview. It's constitutional that the states are in charge of elections. So we will be having elections in August and November this year.
Can you assure Orange County voters there will be a free and fair midterm election?
I can assure them that. And we are working with our community partners to make sure that voters are safe and that the polls will be accessible to everybody.
Karen Castor-Dental is the Orange County Supervisor of Elections.
We have learned a Central Floridian is among the first American casualties of war in Iran. Captain Cody Cork from Winter Haven died in a drone strike on a U.S. command center in Kuwait a day after the United States and Israel launched joint strikes against Iran last week that killed its supreme leader. The Iranian monarchy was overthrown in 1979 and replaced by the Islamic Republic, which has ruled ever since. Dozens of Central Floridians gathered in downtown Orlando to celebrate the possible end of that regime, a moment many have waited decades to see.
We've been waiting for that day, this day, for almost 47, since the day one, since 1979.
They waved large flags, the American flag and the flag of Iran prior to the Islamic Revolution. They chanted, they played music, and danced outside of City Hall. Red Make America Great Again hats were passed out to show appreciation for President Trump's actions.
I'm happy. This is the best moment of my life.
I mean, our past events here in downtown Orlando, we have been chanting President Trump, enough delay, act today. We have been chanting President Trump, now is the time. We have been chanting Iran is rising, the world is watching. That is no longer the case because we got what we wanted and what we demanded.
That was the organizer of Sunday's demonstration, Puyan Balushian. He is the former president of the Iranian American Community Center of Central Florida and estimates 7,000 Iranians live in Central Florida. Balushian says the people of Iran are showing a level of excitement never seen before.
In a normal situation, when a country is under attack, the people of that country, they're not excited. They are not happy. They have a lot of uncertainty. They have a lot of fear. This, however, is a unique situation, which is exactly the opposite reaction, because the dictatorship is about to be gone and freedom is at reach.
The joint U.S. and Israel military operation against Iran killed the Middle Eastern country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who had been in power since 1989. Human rights organizations have long accused him of violently suppressing dissidents. And his opponents blame him for the deaths of thousands of protesters in Iran. His death was celebrated by Iranian Americans who gathered in Central Florida this weekend, including Omid Zohrabania, who moved to the U.S. from Iran in 2016 and now lives in Orlando.
I was born 1982, and my father was arrested 1984 when I was 2 years old, and he was sentenced to death because he was against this brutal regime, against Ayatollah Khomeini. He was in the jail for almost 15 years. And because my uncle was killed in the war between Iran and Iraq, so the sentence was downgraded to lifetime in prison. And after that, he released after 15 years. So since I was 2 years old, I knew that how brutal this regime is.
Sunday's rally brought joy to the streets of Orlando and hope for a brighter future. Questions remain about what comes next here and abroad. Representative Anna Eskamani is the first Iranian-American elected to the Florida legislature.
I grew up with parents that left Iran and never could go back. And that is the story of so many Iranians in the diaspora across the world. My mom always talked about how oppressive this government was, how it separated her from her sisters, and being a working class family, even calling Iran was a scarce experience because of the long distance calls before we had internet access. And then even when we had the access to dial-up, the most exciting aspect for my mom was being able to email her family, because it would take about 23 days for a letter to get from Orlando to Iran. And the ability to connect with her family in that way was incredibly meaningful, especially since she passed away without ever getting to see her family. And my first time in Iran was actually to bring my mom's ashes there in 2005. And to meet all my aunts, uncles, and cousins was and continues to be a gift.
The Orlando Democrat says the Iranian people deserve freedom and self-determination. And at the same time, as an elected official, she is concerned about consequences of prolonged U.S. military involvement.
It's super personal because I have family in Iran. And of course, it's important to stress that the Islamic Republic of Iran is a brutal and repressive regime that for nearly five decades now has imprisoned, tortured, executed, silenced, massacred its own people. And so for many of us in the diaspora, there are no tears shed for the death of Ayatollah Khamenei and other officials within the regime. In fact, there's celebration. And there's celebration even in the streets of Iran, despite the risk of coming out to the streets, there continues to be just jubilation over that. And as an Iranian American, it is very deeply personal, because I don't think you can love the country of Iran without mourning what has been stolen by this regime. And for many in the diaspora, this moment is layered with a combination of emotions, from hope to fear and uncertainty. At that same time, as elected official, there's a very unique responsibility that I have on my shoulders, not only to be a liaison representative of the diaspora, of the Iran-American community, but of course, to also acknowledge that there's a lot of risk involved in what is taking place, a lot of uncertainty, and of course, the need for congressional oversight. And when I think about the U.S. service members who have already lost their lives and the risk of so many more, alongside the impact of any military intervention war on innocent civilians, it just gives me a lot of stress, anxiety, and concern when it comes to the days, weeks, and even months ahead. And we know that Americans overwhelmingly oppose military intervention, and President Trump campaigned on no more wars. And so, you know, all of this is kind of bubbling up inside, and it's been a very, very heavy situation for me to navigate, because I'm also concerned about the safety of my family in Iran, the safety of our service members alongside innocent civilians in the entire region, as we see the ripple effect of Saturday's assault.
We know that a soldier from Winter Haven was among those killed in Kuwait. Are you hearing from military families in Central Florida about that loss or that risk that comes with this war?
Yeah, that's a really, really great question. My heart hurts so deeply for all of our service members, especially a fellow Floridian, incredibly young, serving his country. And this is why, historically, I have always maintained a track record of maintaining peace and learning from our past when it comes to engaging in military conflict and intervention. And my only hope is that the family of our lost service members know that they are being hugged by a grateful nation and a grateful people, and the memories of their loved ones will forever be a blessing. But again, it's important for us to, especially in our capacity, elected officials, take every step that we can to mitigate harm, to mitigate loss of life for our service members and for civilians. And it's very difficult to understand the civilian impact, especially in Iran, because the regime in their brutal ways have also cut down on the internet. There's also been a circulating text message that some have said is coming from police stations in Iran, telling people that if they try to connect to the internet, that'll be a crime. I mean, it's just so many layers of concern, and it just further creates the complexity for the members of the diaspora in this moment that are sitting within, again, experiences of hope and fear at the same time.
We've heard from a number of Iranian Americans living in Central Florida who are praising President Trump's military action. I'm wondering if anything about the strike was handled correctly to you.
I think for me, it's a difficult question to answer, because we're still navigating the ripple effect of it. you know, at this point, there's no clear indication of an imminent threat to the United States. If Israel was planning to strike Iran, we would absolutely put U.S. service members in harm's way. So if that was Israel's intention and they were going to move forward without United States blessings, then I don't think the United States has a choice but to engage and respond, because that absolutely puts all of us in harm's way when there is an initiation of such a direct action. And I do think that it's important to put, you know, partisanship aside in these situations, because our service members, regardless of their political party, are now going to be in harm's way and already are. But I know that these debates often break down in you know, party line dynamics. And I do think this is why you need congressional oversight, because the work of our members of Congress who serve in these committees, its intention is to mitigate risk and mitigate harm, and to strategize around what is a shared goal. And what frustrates me about the Trump administration is that there's been no clarity on the actual next steps. You know, there's now conversation of arming Kurdish rebels. There's conversations around, you know, handpicking individuals to lead a democratic Iran. And it's really important to center the future of Iran on the people of Iran, not dictated by their repressive government or engineered through indefinite foreign intervention, but to lift up the voices of those who are in the country directly impacted. But it also sets a precedent that I know others are expressing concern about when it comes to the role the United States plays in not just Iran, but in governments around the world, in exercising military intervention with regimes and governments that the United States does not consider to be aligned. And that is a very important conversation for Congress to have.
How would you like to see this end?
Oh, my God. Yeah, I think we all share the same vision. You know, we all share a vision that Iran has a democratic transition and that one is led by the people of Iran. And of course, people in the streets of Iran and, of course, here in the diaspora have been uplifting the Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi as a transition figure. If you ask everyday members of the American public, they might not know his name, but in the diaspora, they do. And of course, you know, President Trump has issued his own opinions about that. And I think there's still a lot to be discussed in that regard. But my hope is that there will be a country that is grounded in respecting all viewpoints, in functional and democratic elections, and one where the people of Iran get to determine their future and their destiny and get to engage in the global environment like they once did.
State Representative Anna Eskamani represents the Orlando area and is the first Iranian-American elected to the Florida legislature. Next here on Engage, light is everything in photography. Coming up, how the time change happening this weekend impacts Central Florida photographers who make a living documenting and preserving memories. You are listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. This weekend on Sunday, March 8th, we move the clocks forward 1 hour at 2 a.m. Sunrise and sunset happen later. We lose an hour of morning light, but the trade-off is we gain an hour of evening light. It's an adjustment that affects people differently. For Orlando photographer Claire Gibbs, the time change shifts her day significantly. She and her husband are wedding photographers in Orlando. At their company, That First Moment, they specialize in Disney weddings at the parks after hours and other big moments in Central Florida. Gibbs says she's in love with their work and the human connection involved with it.
I love that every weekend I get a very private window into the lives of everybody that I meet. I get to meet their parents, their siblings, what made them tick, and then just seeing true love on camera and being able to play with those two people that we meet and those two souls we engage with and really getting to see their onset of their story and see them grow together. Sometimes we capture the proposal, the engagement, and then seeing them go through all the nerves to the big day, seeing it come together, we get very personally involved and committed to seeing their day just go right.
How important is lighting to your business?
Lighting is the business. The cameras are important. The light is more important. You could take an amazing image on your phone with the right light. You could take a crappy image with your camera in the wrong light. Truly, light is the essence of what we do.
When we spring forward, what actually changes for photographers?
It's amazing once we spring forward for photographers in the sense that we have more time with our clientele. A lot of our clientele are racing the clock to get off work and having time to do their engagement session, with them being able to still like fit in some makeup and being able to run to catch sunset. Whereas when we fall back, we're getting dark at, 5:30. To me, I think that the biggest thing is being able to have golden hour accessible to everybody, because there are some photographers who do morning sessions with families because kids have more energy at that time and they fit it before their day. But those are few and far in between. Most are organizing with their work schedules and their kids' schedules to make sure that we meet at like 6 p.m. or 7 p.m. So we have the perfect hour, hour and a half of golden light.
I've heard of golden hour. For someone who's not a professional photographer, what is it? What does it actually look like for you?
So golden hour is about an hour before the sun goes under the earth on your side of the spectrum. But that hour changes light into a beauty filter for photographers. For us, it is the difference between light hitting you on top and making dark eye circles at noon to like rimming you in gold. I personally love golden hour. I can make beautiful flares. The light's softer. It feels more magical. And it really does tell the essence of the talent in what you're doing as a photographer, because you are chasing like this golden aura around your clients to really encapsulate their love and encapsulate that emotion they're trying to tell in that story that you're photographing.
Is that a commonly held belief among the photographer community, or do some people find this time of year annoying?
It goes both ways, and there is no right answer. Honestly, every artist is their own, and there are some who don't even use natural light, and they're in the studio working and making an amazing art. There are people who can be in noon light and find a way to make it rough and edgy and really speak to a specific clientele. It really depends on your frame of mind and what you're trying to envision for the day. I just had an argument with my friend about a week ago about daylight savings time. So it's very funny when I got reached out for this. I was like, well, actually, I was just very passionately speaking about this. He likes the other way. He likes it where it's lighter earlier to get shoots done out in the morning and be able to have the afternoon. I would love for it to forever stay a long day. When the sunset goes at 5, I'm normally having to meet the clients around 3, which means I'm already prepping for the photo shoot by like 1. And so my day is literally when I wake up till 1 o'clock. Whereas on a day where the sunset goes down at 8, I'm able to do my whole office, answer emails, maybe even get a little home stuff done, and then also be able to go out and really enjoy the time with our couples.
The sun is critical to your business.
It is. How a person is hit by the light tells a whole story. I always joke with the grooms because I like to educate about light. And I'm just like, hey, stand here. And I said, you see how my face is half sun? And I'll always put the sun on one side and half dark. I said, now whenever you see a movie, you'll notice that men are half lit. They're lit on one side and they're dark on the other. And this creates a mystery, a more strong feeling when you're seeing a man, where a woman is full lit. I'll turn myself fully to the light. And that gives them the more soft, delicate features showing both sides of the face. And from now on, whenever you see a TV show or movie, you will notice half on man, full on woman, unless they're trying to make the woman look nefarious or in a situation where they're stronger. Things like that are things we look for as photographers when we're posing also our clientele.
I fear that you might have just changed my TV and viewing watching habits.
You'll never unsee it once you notice it.
Do you notice different colors in the sky in spring versus winter?
I do. In the winter, it's a lot more colorful, a lot more vibrant. The skies tend to, I like to say, be on fire. You'll see a lot more powerful sunsets. No matter what, you'll have gorgeous sunsets in Florida. We're spoiled here.
If you could leave us with a pro tip, what's something that you see people doing who aren't professionals trying to take a picture in the bright sun that we should not be doing?
Go with your gut. Your instinct is what's going to make you a true artist. I like having my clients face away from the sun. In fact, my pro tip is to follow the shadow and shoot from the bottom of the shadow in the direction, and that'll give you the best rim lighting, especially during golden hour.
Claire Gibbs is the lead content director and artist at That First Moment Photography based in Central Florida.
For years and years, folks got along with an old grandfather's clock, or just a common old sundial sitting out on a rock. Then the dollar watch, it had its day, and the wristwatch, it was fine. Then along came a man that ruined us all with daylight saving time.
That's all for this week's edition of Engage. We need your help with a future segment. Florida lawmakers are debating eliminating property taxes. How would these changes affect you and your family? Send an email to engage@cfpublic.org and help us shape the conversation. I'm Sharon Stone. Thank you for the company. NPR News is next.